The use of force leads to perverse, unintended consequences. Perverse, unintended consequences lead to new problems. New problems lead to a public demand for government action. A public demand for government action leads to the use of force, which leads to perverse unintended consequences, which leads to new problems, which leads to new demands for government action, which leads to the use of force, which leads to perverse unintended consequences,
which leads to new problems, which leads to new demands for government action, which leads to the use of force, which leads to perverse unintended consequences, which leads to new problems, which leads to the demand for more government action, which leads to...
American History F, Part 6, The War on Fire. Critical thinking question. And although the situation in this question is going to sound completely ridiculous, I assure you that it is far less absurd than what people actually tolerate and pay for every day with government. What would you think if you witnessed an arsonist running back to the scene of their crime just moments later with a fire hose? And for goodness sake, what would you do to intervene? If you also realized that they had somehow managed to hook the fire hose up to a tank of gasoline. If we think about the way that we learn history in government school, an important follow-up question is always, what are the consequences of learning this fictionalized version of the past? What are the consequences of learning that Abraham Lincoln was this heroic visionary who not only set an entire race of people free, but also saved us all from certain doom? And that less than 100 years later, another man, Franklin Roosevelt, rescued the country from economic ruin while leading everyone to safety through the most dangerous geopolitical time in the country's history. These are pretty astonishing feats that have been accomplished by these men who are used to personify government. So the result would be obvious. We should certainly be saying to ourselves, if government can solve those problems, those amazing, seemingly insurmountable, complex problems, certainly we should let government try its hand at, well, everything else. And in the last several decades, we've seen that happen. We've seen that accelerate up to the present day, where now it seems to be healthcare that they are targeting for improvement. And of course, this is a perfect example of the arsonist returning with fire hose in hand. Because the primary reason why healthcare is so expensive in the United States is the government. America has a more than 50% socialized system already. You can look at the lobbying influence of the AMA, which has dramatically increased the cost of healthcare over the 20th century. That would not be possible without government intervention. I talked about this in an earlier episode entitled Politics is Force, but Stefan Molyneux has also covered this on Free Domain Radio in his True News series. He did a two-part look at healthcare that is definitely worth checking out, and I will put a link to that in the show notes. But this is not new. Whatever the problem is, whether the government created it or not, if there is a call for government to deal with the problem, the government has one card to play. Force, violence, aggression, predation, theft. That sounded like a lot of cards. Let's just call it all force. Sometimes they openly declare war on something, on a noun, on an abstract concept. Sometimes the war is a little bit covert. Like right now, for example, there is a covert war on the idea that health insurance companies should be able to make a profit. But because no one can really fight against abstractions or vague nouns, any war that the government declares, which signifies an acceleration of the use of force in a certain area, even though it's declared on a noun, it is fought against people. Usually innocent people who are harming no one. Now, at this point in this history series, it would be redundant for me to spend half hour to 45 minutes debunking the myth that government solves problems. We've already addressed that. Instead, today, I want to talk about unintended consequences that result from government attempts to solve problems. Now, many people who are listening who are already familiar with this idea might be saying, you're going to do a show about the unintended consequences of government action. This show is going to be like 14 hours long. Well, we're going to kind of target it to a specific topic a little bit, like a case study in just one area where the government has intervened significantly. And that would be the war on drugs. The radio talk program Free Talk Live for years has done a superb job of following news that relates to the expansion of government power, new government programs and initiatives and projects that come into being for the ostensible purpose of solving some kind of problem. Free Talk Live has also been around long enough to be able to report back later on the perverse, sometimes comical, sometimes tragic side effects of those government projects. Today, the host of Free Talk Live, Ian Freeman, is my guest to talk about the unintended consequences of the war on drugs. Ian and I actually wound up talking for nearly an hour and a half, and we covered a lot of ground on a number of different topics. So I've actually split the interview into two parts. Today's show will deal with our discussion on the war on drugs exclusively. And then another episode will follow in the next few days.
Michael Jackson's death unleashed a flurry of media stories about all aspects of the pop star's life, including his alleged prescription drug abuse.
His prescription drug use and alleged abuse.
Pop star's possible drug use.
The pop star was taking a combination of Demerol, Vicodin, Dilaudid, Xanax.
On the same day, countless millions watched Jackson's star-studded memorial service. Reason TV interviewed another musician. This song is by Sean Clark Redmond, a man who enjoyed an active life before the neurodegenerative disease ALS, often referred to as Lou Gehrig's disease, rendered him nearly immobile. He can no longer even play the piano. The disease also left him in nearly constant pain.
At times, the pain can go so deep, it feels like, you know, it's right down to the bone.
Unlike Michael Jackson, Redmond admits to having a problem with pain medication. However, his problem is very different than the one the King of Pop is rumored to have had.
Since Michael Jackson's death, we're learning more about rampant abuse.
Redmond's isn't the overdosing problem we hear so much about.
This is underdosing.
Redmond's caretaker and partner, Steve Altman, says Redmond is prescribed some medication, but not nearly enough to keep his pain under control.
It's just so frustrating and stressful to watch him in pain and know that there are forces behind us that don't want him to get the medication he needs. When he doesn't have the medication, it's hell.
I want to die. You know, I just want to die.
Chronic pain in America is an enormously undertreated disease. It's a public health disaster.
Dr. Frank Fisher is a Harvard-trained physician. He says Redmond's plight is an appallingly common one. Instead of receiving the medication they need, millions of Americans suffer needlessly, according to Fisher and other pain specialists. Consider nursing home residents. According to findings published in the Journal of the American Medical Association, 41% of them endure severe chronic pain. How could that be? Because law enforcement interferes with the doctor-patient relationship, making doctors fearful of prescribing high doses of opioids.
When a patient develops severe chronic pain, basically there's only one class of medications that's going to work. That's opioid analgesics.
Oxycontin.
Demerol. Vicodin.
In other words, the same pain medication so often associated with celebrity overdose and addiction.
Well, these celebrity cases are propaganda. They don't reflect the problem with these drugs in America.
Fisher practices medicine far outside the Hollywood paparazzi zone in the northern California town of Rio Del. He has no celebrity clients. As he's done throughout his career, he treats mainly poor people.
Poor people are already suspected of being drug addicts and criminals, and so are the doctors that treat them with controlled substances.
Fisher should know.
I was arrested when a SWAT team of about 20 law enforcement officials descended on my clinic at 9 in the morning.
Dr. Fisher was thrown in jail and charged with drug trafficking. And because some of his patients died with pain medication in their systems, he was also charged with 5 counts of murder.
They were trying to give me 256 to life, and that's pretty hair-raising to be sitting there looking at that sort of thing.
The murder charges were thrown out after investigators determined that his patients' deaths had nothing to do with the medication Fisher prescribed. Eventually, all charges against Fisher were dropped, but not before the doctor spent 5 months behind bars and years fighting to get his medical license back. 10 years on, he's still struggling.
It cost everything I had to defend myself and whatever I could borrow. And at this point, I'm 56 years old. And I'm starting over, and I have a net worth of zero.
What causes doctors to worry about cops and jails when they should be focused on treating patients?
What we're dealing with is a mass insanity. We call it the war on drugs.
The United States isn't supposed to be at war with itself.
Altman blames the drug war for the ongoing fight he wages with doctors to get Redman the medicine he needs.
They're afraid if they write that prescription, oh my God, they're going to get locked in jail. They're going to get put away.
It's true that most doctors don't get prosecuted. But it only takes a couple here and there, and that keeps the rest of the physicians in line.
The harder they clamp down, the harder it is for me to live with this disease.
Recently, President Obama's drug czar announced that he wants law enforcement to strengthen its monitoring of those who use prescription drugs. For Reason TV, I'm Nick Gillespie.
Dreams that will come to you when you're wide open, let them into your mind. Happens more often times, not while you're waiting, no, not while you're waiting for anything.
I'm being joined by Ian Freeman of Free Talk Live and freekeen.com. Ian, how are you?
Hey, good morning, Brett. Doing great.
Great. In school, I feel like in our history classes, in our civics classes, in our government classes, we're always given this sort of myth of a great man or a great group of men versus some kind of great challenge. And, you know, the tool that they always seem to be using to address that challenge and ultimately conquer it is government. So chapter after chapter, story after story, what we learn is that the government actually solves problems all the time.
Yeah, I mean, when kids are growing up, they're basically told that if you want something to be solved, that's how you do it. That, you know, you just go to the legislature, have them pass a law, and then voila. Problem solved.
Exactly. And I thought I would just, I right before we got on Skype this morning, I had the resolution to an ongoing problem that I'd been dealing with for some time here in New Hampshire that isn't entirely related to some of the things that I wanted to talk about, but definitely an interesting story. Probably would have made a good call for Free Talk Live. In New Hampshire, for people who aren't aware, we have these things called inspection stickers, which basically certifies your vehicle as safe. And I'm sure you've been here long enough to know that they've recently packaged with the vehicle's safety inspection sticker some kind of emissions certification to make sure that the vehicle is environmentally friendly, I guess.
I have a car that was given to me, and it's not in my name, so it was a New Hampshire car. And I did have that inspected once. I didn't notice really much about that. And this year I took the inspection sticker off and the plates off and put a private plate on. So I'm not playing that game anymore.
It's just unfortunate that I depend on the car so much for what I do. I mean, I used to drive for what I do 600 miles a week. I've gotten that down to maybe 150 now. But I was pulled over a couple weeks ago. And it's interesting, too, because we always talk about, you know, the violence of the state in overseas in places like Iraq or all the people who are thrown in jail for nonviolent crimes. But, you know, as I'm just kind of sitting in my home day to day minding my own business, a lot of that violence, you know, even though I understand the opportunity cost of the state and even though I'm aware of all these things that the state does, it kind of becomes an abstraction at times. And I know that's probably less true for you and people out in Keene, where you guys are more regularly challenging law enforcement officials. But here on the seacoast, where I'm not so involved in those things, it has a tendency to not always feel palpable until something like, getting pulled over by the police. So I have a sticker on my car that I got in April. It turns out that my birthday is in August, and the sticker, which is supposed to be good for a year, automatically expires in August. And, I have a Volkswagen. It's a relatively new car, but it's, you know, expensive to fix things. And I bring it to get a new inspection sticker, even though my last one has been good within the last year, and it doesn't pass this emissions test. So in order to drive my car, I need this sticker, according to the law, and I wind up spending a whole bunch of time, a whole bunch of effort, a little bit of money to get the car to a point where it will pass an emissions test, which has absolutely nothing to do with safety. And as I was describing the problem and my frustration to one of the mechanics who was working on the car, he said, you know, this has been such a hassle for all of us who do these inspections that we don't even have the time to really, because of this emissions standard thing, we don't even have the time to check the cars for, guess what?
For safety.
For safety. So like now to get the cars in and out as fast as they can, they're not even really checking for safety. And it was just a sort of local, small-scale, unintended consequences story that just wrapped up for me today.
Well, Brett, you know what you can do in this case. You can report that inspector to the Department of Motor Vehicles and Inspection and Regulation, and they will come in and teach them a lesson.
Well, he said that this is a serious problem that everybody is having. I think they would have to set out on some whole new kind of enforcement project to...
We need to think operations. We need to pass a new law, new regulations. That'll solve this problem and show these car dealers how to do business.
Right. A crackdown.
And isn't that what we're talking about here? The mentality that people have that, well, the car dealerships aren't doing what they're told to be doing, so we just need to tell them to do more things.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. And so as I'm pulling out, I was pulling out of there this morning at about 9 o'clock with a big grin on my face, like I had accomplished something. And you know, as I'm pulling out of the repair shop and headed on my way back home, it occurs to me that all of this effort, all of this money, all of this time that I just devoted to this project was to get a sticker that says I can use my own property. And
yeah.
It just absolutely blew my mind as I was driving home that I was I had some feeling of satisfaction. It was almost embarrassing for a minute. So,
feeling like a good little cog in the system.
It's just like this major problem that had been solved. And I was like, well, why is this even a problem? And, so all of that effort, all of that time for absolutely nothing productive. My car is safe because, and I'm sure of that, because it's mine and I depend on it. And, you know, I wouldn't want to be operating a motor vehicle that was dangerous or that could land me in legitimate legal hot water if I my brakes failed or a tire blew and I hit somebody else. It's amazing how thoughtful and careful and considerate a person can be without even knowing what the laws are. I think that that would surprise a lot of people in law enforcement, but...
Yeah.
So the unintended consequences of inspection stickers in the Free State. And I think that's a nice segue to this this topic, this myth that our history creates that the government solves problems. And usually when they identify a problem, the next step is to declare a war on it. And I think we've seen this time and time again. I can think of four that would that most people would be familiar with: the war on drugs, the war on terror, the war on crime, and the war on poverty. And the first thing that I thought we could discuss, and you know, if this is all we discuss because it's such a large topic, that's certainly fine. But is the war on drugs? How does the war on drugs work? What is this? And most importantly, what are its effects?
Well, it's the same as what we've been talking about, the same theme of a group of busybodies, a group of know-it-alls and do-gooders that think they know what the appropriate moral code is and the way people should live their lives, have decided to codify their beliefs and write down some words on paper, call them laws or statutes, and then proceed to threaten other people with cages if they decide to violate them. I mean, it's the same story, just when we're talking about drugs in this case. And not all drugs, obviously, because, you know, the people that are the moralists, they have their drugs, and that's okay. Reminds me of these 420 celebrations that have been going on out here in New Hampshire, specifically in Keene and Manchester. In fact, I think there's one scheduled today for the jail in Manchester. But these 420 celebrations, at one point, there were some anti-drug people or drug warriors, if you will, that came out and brought some signs to do a counter demonstration, basically. And so, you know, I saw them out there, and they were actually out there fairly early at like 2 in the afternoon. Of course, the 420 thing didn't start till 420. So I saw them, heard that they were out there. I went and took a walk downtown and went up and talked to them for a little while. And of course, you know, during the conversation, which was very, you know, very friendly, during the conversation, unearthed a number of inconsistencies and confusion that was going on in their minds. And one of the more interesting ones, I thought, was that they had cups of coffee with them. And, you know, I pointed this out to them, that that they were there using a drug right there called caffeine. And that, you know, don't they have a problem with that? I mean, this is a mind-altering substance, and it's an addictive substance. And I pointed these things out, and of course, they just were heavily in denial. I mean, this is okay. Caffeine is okay. It's not illegal. These other drugs are illegal, and therefore, they're bad. They're hurting families. They're doing damage. And so it's okay for them to use their mind-altering drug of choice. It's everybody else, they can't use, you know, marijuana or MDMA or whatever it is that they want. I mean, just the blistering hypocrisy of these people.
And it seems like this entire this pursuit against drugs began pretty much in the 1960s, I think, as a counter to a lot of the Vietnam War protests that were always linked to marijuana and LSD use. Obviously, it's expanded. It was sort of reinvented, I think, in the 1980s to go after harder drugs. Why do you think that these moralists, whether it was, you know, we're talking about the people in the 60s who were against that counterculture movement, or the people who reinvigorated the drug war in the 1980s, didn't learn from the moralists who had come before them, whose major legislative victory was prohibition, which basically led to the invention or the expansion, a dramatic expansion in organized crime in the United States.
Maybe it's the same reason why the American people haven't learned from the various different socialist medicine systems around the world. I would suggest two reasons. One, they don't know. You know, they have the truth obscured from them from their government history classes. Or number two, even if the history classes have touched on these issues, as I recall, mine touched on prohibition. Even if they've discussed these issues, the issues of prohibition and the failures therein, perhaps they simply believe that their prohibition won't be subject to those rules. You know, that, well, if you put me in charge of prohibiting a substance, I will configure the system in a way that will not be beaten. I will create laws that are so draconian and so tough that people will be so frightened that they won't dare to traffic in such products. And in the same way that the Americans must believe that given all the horror stories of socialized medicine, like people in Canada not getting treatments or having to wait months and months and dying in the meantime, they can just plug their ears and say, well, that's Canada. We'll do it better.
So you really believe that, and you know, this is a question that I often have when we look at government action and unintended consequences. You really believe that a lot of these things have their genesis in someone's good intentions. Is that fair to say?
I think that's absolutely the case. I mean, having interacted fairly often with the government bureaucrats up here, it's one of the things that has changed for me since I've moved to New Hampshire as part of the Free State Project. Back when I was down in Florida, I had a lot more anger and a lot more hatred toward the system and, you know, this belief that these people are evil. And true enough, what they're doing is evil, putting people in jail cells who are peaceful and stealing property from people. Obviously, these are immoral and evil acts. But to us, it's obvious. But to them, it's just how things work. And it's their only solution to what they perceive as societal problems. And having had enough conversations with folks like Cynthia on the local talk show here, Talkback, which airs on LibertyRadioNetwork.com on Saturday mornings, actually right now while we're recording this program, you know, having talked to them and having met them in person and looked into their eyes and had discussions with them, it's pretty clear to me that a lot of these people, the government people, really do believe that what they're doing is the best way to solve problems in society. And of course, they're so established in their belief system that the suggestion that doing something differently, like changing to a voluntary society or consensual based interaction between humans, just seems so radical because, well, this is the way it's always been done.
It's interesting, too, though. I think that there certainly is a pretty standard psychological profile of people who are attracted to government work, especially at a political decision-making level, where they basically at some point have to say to themselves, you know, I am a smart enough and special enough that I should be able to make decisions that affect the lives of complete strangers. And because I'm just so damn smart and special, and people like me are the same, those decisions, those decrees, should be imposed on these people with force for their own good.
I don't doubt that that's true for some of them. It's probably true that some of them are really that full of themselves. But of course, they'd never admit it publicly. But I think there are a number of them that just tell themselves a story. They have this, and it's a story they learn in government school, right?
Yes.
The story is that, well, yeah, okay, I can see all these, the free staters, for instance, have pointed out all of these things that the city government is doing, but they elected me. I mean, that's why I'm here. I'm here because I was chosen. The people have told me that this is what they want. I mean, yeah, some of them tell me that's not what they want, but I've been elected to make these decisions. So on one hand, maybe some of them think that they're just, you know, the greatest thing since sliced bread. On the other hand, maybe they really, they feel very humbled by the idea that they have been, you know, given the endorsement of thousands of people in the area to go and do these things.
Yeah, it's interesting too, and you start to see how tangled the knot is that we have to kind of untie there, where once you say, okay, well, if it looks like violence and it sounds like violence and it feels like violence, or, you know, even using the word force interchangeably there, then that's probably what it is and that's probably wrong, then it's a very quick jump to this magic ritual of voting that somehow makes it okay. But if we go back and we look at an organization like the DEA, where there are no elected officials in that organization, there is no electoral process that sets policy for that agency, we see something entirely different. We see people who cannot hide behind that this is the will of the majority anymore.
Yeah, but they always have that to go back to. They can always say that, well, we were created by the legislature, and the legislature gave us the permission to write our own ordinances, and the legislature was elected by the people. So we're clearly what the people want. Otherwise, the people would tell the legislature to get rid of us. It's just a convenient excuse for every single time. No matter what the government agencies are doing, you try to nail them down. You know, I called TalkBack this morning about the fact that they're aggressing against some peaceful people that built a shack in the woods, and the owner of the property there doesn't have a problem with them being there. They are enjoying their shack, and they even went and they made changes to the shack to once the fire department came out and gave them suggestions. They made those changes, but that's still not good enough because they didn't get the permission slip up first, up front. And so I asked my usual set of questions about who really owns the property. And, well, of course, you really own the property, but we get to tell you what to do because, well, there was an election and you selected these people to tell you what to do. And I said, well, no, I didn't. And they, of course, they don't have any answer to that. But, well, it's the election. It's always the justification is that somebody out there checked a box. And because somebody checked a box, even though it wasn't you, that's a good enough reason to tell you what to do. It's a sickness.
So when you combine these, the confusion of some bureaucrats, you know, based on things that they learned in government school about the nobility or the virtue of what they're involved in, with the psychological profile of people who want to attain or retain power over the lives of other people, and this series of rationalizations that they can use to perpetuate this, it creates quite a perfect storm for things that actually are evil. Like we said, yeah. We don't, and I said, when Gardner and I were talking in the last show, I said, I don't want to cast these people as James Bond villains that are just, there's no, there's nothing in the plot about why they're so evil. They're just evil, and we have to accept that. I mean, you have to drill down a little bit deeper than that. But you see this perfect storm that's created that leads to things that truly are evil. And I think that the drug war is certainly probably the best example of that. And we talked a little bit about prohibition, and there's these prohibition economics. Like, why does prohibition perpetuate drug use, drug dealing, and that whole industry?
Does prohibition really perpetuate it? I don't know about that, because if you look at the statistics of people that are addicted to drugs today, they really aren't higher than they were prior to prohibition. So I don't know if it perpetuates it, but there are certainly some unintended consequences that may perhaps spread drug use in ways that otherwise it wouldn't spread. When a product is banned, whether it's drugs or alcohol or guns or prostitution, whenever anything is prohibited, the demand doesn't really go away. It just goes underground. So it's really a fantasy of this, of the people involved in the state, that their laws and their ordinances, their statutes or ordinances, will have some effect on whether or not people are willing to engage in certain behaviors. And maybe it does. You know, maybe there's a percentage point of people out there that want to smoke pot real, real bad, but just won't do it because they're so afraid they might get caught and thrown in a cage. I suppose that could be the case. But on an overall picture, it's statistically insignificant. People doing it.
Yeah, we could replace a word like use, maybe that wasn't the best word choice, with danger or violence. I know that we have a mutual friend who told a story on your show maybe 5 or 6 months ago about a member of his family who almost died because he was being tested for marijuana, which in most respects is a relatively harmless drug, but in order to get high was using dangerous sort of over-the-counter medication or prescription drugs. And we start seeing this more and more, addiction to pharmaceutical prescription drugs, or the trading. A student in school might be prescribed some certain drug, and they'll turn around and sell it to other people. I think those kinds of occurrences are a lot more common, and also the emergence of new drugs that are extremely dangerous, like crystal meth, crack cocaine, both products of the drug war, are they not?
That's true. Yeah, it's probably the case that crack and crystal meth would not have hit the market in the absence of drug prohibition. I think crack is known to have become really widespread during the crackdown that they did on cocaine back in the 1980s. And so crack was kind of a response to a increase in the strength of the prohibition. So there are definitely some serious unintended consequences that that result from prohibition. I mean, liquor was created for the same reasons, you know, because it's more concentrated. It's easier to transport a bunch of bottles of liquor that are going to get people a lot more drunk in a much smaller amount of time than it is to transport a whole bunch of bottles of beer. And so would liquor have come about? Would crack would have crystal meth come about? We don't know. I mean, obviously there's a possibility it could have anyway, but we do know that they were certainly encouraged to come about by the result of prohibition. And of course, there's so many other unintended consequences. I think one of the best ones, and I don't mean best in a good way, but one of the best examples is the violence. You know, the danger and the thefts and the burglaries and the robberies that are generated by the people that are looking to score another hit. These products like crack are very, very addictive. And the users, unless they're very independently wealthy, have to come up with a way to get the money to spend on their habit. And the only way they know how to do that, unless they're selling the drug themselves, is to go out and steal stuff, to break into people's cars, to break into homes, to hold people up at gunpoint, to rob stores and things like that. You talk to any cop that's honest, and they'll tell you that almost every burglary suspect that they catch, almost every person who's breaking and entering and stealing and things like that, are doing it to get money for drugs. And it's just a tremendous amount of violent and property crime that comes out of this drug prohibition. We would literally have crime rates drop almost overnight if drug prohibition were to end. And I mean all of it. I'm not talking about just marijuana, as some people would suggest. It all needs to end because there aren't very many people that are knocking over convenience stores to get a bag of pot.
Right, indeed. And I think this is the myth that drugs create crime has been revealed as is incorrect and false, and that the truth is that drug prohibition is what creates crime, because
absolutely.
Prices are driven up by the black market. Obviously, and this is something we can touch on in a minute, but from cocaine coming out of the ground as a plant to being handed to the end user in a baggie is a long and difficult process, especially since it's been driven underground. I mean, if you think about the amount of effort that it takes to produce a bar of chocolate, which might come in, 8 ounces for $1.50, is significantly more difficult than growing marijuana, taking marijuana from a seed to something that is smokable. The cost, the effort, the time. But 8 ounces of marijuana, I would have to guess. Half a pound.
Wow,
looking, it's well over $1,000 for that. Where chocolate, a more difficult production process, you can get for $1.50. So we see what the black market does to prices. Another unintended consequence seems to be increased corruption of police, law enforcement.
Yeah, there are even rumors around here that one of the police officers sells drugs out of his car. I mean, yeah, there's no end to the, and I would say the rumors are fairly, fairly well founded, from the people that I've heard them from, but there's no end to this. And I don't blame the cops. I mean, there are very few people who could resist the temptation in that, if they pulled someone over and found, a bunch of, marijuana in their car, to just take it because, well, what are they going to do? Complain that you stole their pot?
Yeah.
You know, take the pot from them or take the coke or whatever it is. Take the cash. And then if you have the connections, you sell the coke or the weed and, you know, you get a couple $1,000s and you didn't even have to pay for it. So, I mean, these are people that are augmenting their salaries with cash bonuses whenever they get the chance. Now, some of them are, you know, they have the integrity to not do that kind of thing. But who knows what the percentage of cops are that would, if they were given the opportunity, shove $1,000 in their pocket if they happen to find it on somebody. I mean, they got bills to pay.
Yeah, and I think an interesting case study, even though it's not always related to drugs, but it's often related to drugs, is what goes on at the U.S. border. If you think about a new border guard being hired at $28,000, $29,000 a year somewhere in Texas, and somebody pulls up and says, here's your whole year's salary, tax-free, in cash, if you let me drive this truck through here, that kind of temptation for some would be nearly impossible to resist. And I think it's the same thing. And drug dealers have talked about this as well, about having cops on their payroll. It's that's the cost of doing business. So, yeah, I think that's another really significant unintended consequence. Not only is it pulling them away from fighting legitimate crime where there's a victim or there's property damage, but it also basically puts them on the payroll of, in some cases, very dangerous criminals.
Absolutely. I mean, in many cases, they can also be threatened. I mean, if the cash doesn't work, threats might work. So if you find one of them who is steadfast enough to refuse to be bribed, well, you can just simply threaten his family. And then, well, he's going to be a little more persuadable at that point. And, of course, the people in the legitimate market don't have to worry about doing things like this. The Budweiser and other beer distributors around the country don't have to pay bribes to at least, well, not the same kind of bribes. They still have to buy their licenses and pay those other sorts of bribes. But they certainly don't have to pay to, you know, men that are standing guard at a certain location to let them through with their product, which is what the black marketeers that are trafficking in drugs and humans have to do. So the idea that increasing the border patrol is going to do anything to stop people from coming here, I mean, just to talk about immigration briefly, which is essentially another prohibition, is not going to do anything, because it's just going to, if you put more guards down on the border, it just means that the black marketeers will have to raise their rates. They'll have to get more money together to pay off the guards. And that means they're going to have to charge the immigrants more to give them the service of, you know, coyote service of traveling, taking them across the border. So they'll just increase their rates, and the people on the other end will pay them. I mean, like you say, a bag of marijuana, a pound of marijuana, you're looking at a significant difference between going to the bagged salad section of your grocery store and picking out a $3 16-ounce bag of salad, whereas a 16 ounces of pot, you're looking at, depending on the grade of the marijuana, you're looking at anywhere from, you know, $800 on up to $5,000.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that, you know, if people are willing to take all these risks to leave Mexico, or, you know, a lot of them leaving Guatemala to go to Mexico and then leaving Mexico to come to the United States, there's increased prices for that service of getting them safely and undetected into the country. That desperation might also drive crime in those places as well. If the costs of those services escalate, people tend to be attracted to crime out of desperation. And, you know, that's another aspect of the drug war, an unintended consequence. In areas where poor areas, inner city areas, the drug war also seems to be attracting children or driving young people in those areas into the underworld or into lives of crimes because of the allure that surrounds the drug dealers. Like, there's, you know, a few people in their neighborhood who have nice cars and live comfortably. And I think that there's a lot of young people who are in desperate situations who want that kind of security.
Absolutely. And in many cases, it can be a motivation of family. There have been plenty of stories, for instance, of people that are living in ghetto areas, and grandma is sick, and they are the only, you know, they're the 14-year-old boy that's at home with living with grandma or something like that, or living with mom. and the family, the elder family member is having a tough time. They're unable to work. He's not going to be able to go out to McDonald's and get a job that's going to pay the rent. But if he goes and starts selling crack, then there's a good chance that he will be able to pay the rent.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, we a lot of people are only talking about this. Even critics of the war on drugs are only talking about its unintended consequences and impacts in the United States. I think that this desperation is far more palpable in places like Colombia, where in, I think, the 1970s and 1980s, the DEA, one of the true examples or the real examples of people spraying stuff out of airplanes. I know there's a lot of conspiracy theorists who are always talking about that, but sprayed crops on small rural farms in the Colombian countryside where they thought the coca plant was being grown, which not only destroyed their number one cash crop for a lot of these farmers who they may not have the same kind of indoctrination or public school system on the Colombian countryside where people are learning that the law is like a religion, like we learn in school, like it's the law and that's what the law says. And they might just say, wow, this is the most profitable thing that I could possibly grow. It's like 10 times more profitable than any other seed that I can stick in the ground. So I'd be insane not to grow it. And then to have their crops destroyed, that desperation, that poverty, was, extremely helpful to the recruitment efforts of a really, really dangerous, violent group called the FARC guerrillas in Colombia, who use that desperation to basically put people into their paramilitary and just escalated the entire country of Colombia pretty much into chaos over this war on drugs, over this coca plant. And I think opium grows there as well. But I mean, these consequences are everywhere where drugs grow or where drugs go.
Yeah, and they might as well grow coke plants or marijuana, because if they try to grow regular crops, there's still a good chance they're going to get buzzed and sprayed and lose the lettuce crops or whatever it is that they were doing. That happens, too, where even the farmers that aren't growing the drugs are ending up losing crops just because they've sprayed in the wrong place or something like that.
Yeah, and you know, the only other thing that really stands out as far as the war on drugs is concerned is about, I think, 1 million people are arrested every year for nonviolent drug-related crimes, either for selling drugs or, in some cases, just using drugs.
Yeah, it never stops. About 1.5 million people in the last year alone were arrested, and it is mostly for possession. I think it's 80 plus percent arrested for that. And of course, the other 20% are certainly not the big timers. You know, the 20% of drug dealers the 20% of people that are arrested for dealing are usually just small time people that had like 2 bags of pot on them. You know, because in a lot of places there are laws or statutes that say that. That if you have more than 1 baggie, then you must be a dealer. So even the 20% statistic seems a little misleading on its face. Most of those people are probably very low level players in the business.
And of course, that this is sold to the public as these people are put where they're supposed to be, in prison. Meanwhile, back on the street, there's, basically this Pez dispenser effect of new potential drug dealers waiting to pop up and take the place of the person who's been incarcerated. Meanwhile, the user and the dealer, for the purposes of a deterrence or for the purposes of rehabilitation, are put into a place, where drugs are used and where drugs are sold, which is the American, correction system.
Sure. Yep, they can't even keep the drugs out of their own prisons, so how can anyone really believe they'll be able to keep them out of the country? It's ludicrous.
Yeah, that's
just ludicrous right on its face.
That's a really good point, that if you talk about a place where law enforcement has total control. It is the jails, and they can't keep drugs out of a building, out of a secure building. So what chance would they really stand on the street or in inner city areas or anywhere? Because obviously, the other problem with unintended consequences of these types of initiatives and programs is mission creep. It expands far beyond its original goals. What is mission creep, first of all?
Well, that's where the government has the government people have an intention to do something, and when they start the program, they create the new program, and that is intended to do that something, that it ends up doing something in B and C and D and E and F, and coming up with other ways to expand the bureaucracy and expand the level of control that they have over people, bring more bureaucrats underneath their control, and expand the budget of the program so they can get more perks down the line. It's just the nature of the state to continue to consume as many resources of the populace that they are extracting them from as they possibly can, all the while saying, well, we're just providing you with more services.
Yeah, and it really seems like the expansion of the mission is inevitable, regardless of how it goes. I mean, if you think about a new bureaucracy or a new program, initially maybe it has some success. If it's a totally new endeavor, they might have to pull people out of productive free enterprise, people who are used to returning something of quality in order to make a living. But after a generation or two, it's failure that's incentivized in these programs. So if they have some initial success with the program and they say, okay, it's working, let's expand it. Or in government, if they fail, it's because they didn't have enough money or enough resources. So it seems like it basically expands either way.
That's true. Yep. And why shouldn't it? I mean, they can just take as much as they want. All they have to do is come up with excuses, and that's what we're talking about. I mean, the excuse to take more is it's worth the program's working, so we need more, or the program is not working, so we need more, or we need to reorganize. So we'll change a bureaucrat out here and there to make it look like we're doing something that'll actually have some significant effect. And all the while, they're just extracting more and more wealth from the productive class of people, from the people that are actually out there providing real products and services that people really are asking for and are willing to pay for on a voluntary basis. So it's just, they're so backwards and so messed up, and it's just so frustrating that there's very little that we can really do about it, at least until we get enough people together to start to make a difference.
Hey, before we wrap up, I know we went a little longer than expected, but I was wondering if we could do a little unintended consequences lightning round.
Okay, sure.
Some government wars. We talked significantly about the war on drugs, but just to get maybe a quick soundbite to get your thoughts on a few others, the war on terror.
Oh, well, that's easy. Terrorism problem, if there is one, was created by the government going and inflicting terror on other people in these other countries. And so really that they're just responding in kind. Of course, it'd be nice if folks just turned the other cheek, but they're doing what they're doing, which is getting angry and lashing out. And I can't say I blame them for that. And of course, as violence will lead to more violence, you'll start to see more terrorists incidents occur as more government people continue to go and kill people around the world. So terrorism is just an unintended consequence of terrorism, which is what the U.S. government engages in.
And of course, perhaps in the most spectacularly tragic unintended consequence of the 20th century, the chain of events that led up to the current situation in places like Iraq and Afghanistan, you can trace back probably to the United States government setting out on a mission during the 19-teens to make the world safe for freedom and democracy. And then you just have this chain of events that one war causing another, causing a Cold War, causing the radicalization of, these Islamists in places like Afghanistan. And that's certainly something that I'm going to explore in more detail in the future. And the war on poverty. How about that?
Well, certainly creating welfare programs has encouraged more people to get on welfare and never get off of it. So I think that the statistics show that poverty hasn't lessened since then, since they created the war, so-called war on it.
And there's one more that you might actually be unfamiliar with, the war on fire. Are you familiar with that?
Fire departments, you mean?
No, this was actually, I believe, in the 1920s or 1930s, an organization called the U.S. Forest Service officially declared a war on fire. Now, as we know, in the last 15 or 20 years, especially in California, there seems to be an increase in the frequency and intensity of wildfires. And most of this has been attributed to global warming. But it turns out that if you trace the history of this back to the declaration of war on this natural phenomenon, that the U.S. Forest Service set out with the goal of eliminating forest fires completely. So this meant when lightning would strike underbrush in a forest and start a small forest fire that would clear out basically what would be the kindling for a major forest fire, they would put it out and leave the kindling there. So over the decades, the kindling has been building up. So now when a forest fire starts, it is just burns uncontrollably. Hmm. That is your war on fire.
Yeah, you know, one of the other things I wanted to point out, I know we're short on time here, but this concept of war on this, war on that, so very typical of governments. And of course, it should be. I mean, that is their only tool, right? Their only tool is threats and violence. So, of course, they're going to agitate for wars on fill in the blank. I think that one of the major transitions I've had in the last few years since I've moved up here to New Hampshire, as I was pointing out, I was very angry before moving up here, and since I've been here and settled in and got to know some of the bureaucrats and the situation that that exists up here, I've really shifted my viewpoint to a position of love and forgiveness and understanding and compassion. And when is it that you're ever going to hear the government have a love on drugs? Or, you know, I don't know what the opposite of war would be, but I'm pretty sure it involves love. So they're never going to do that because it's just not their tool. And of course they can't until they finally start respecting the other, their fellow man and not aggressing against them. None of these problems in society are going to be solved by aggression and solved through war. They never have. And they never will be, because violence only begets more violence. And the more violent and aggressive the state becomes, the more likely people are going to lash out in violence against it and encourage the state to grow and create more wars and escalate their wars. And it's just a never ending cycle that, if people continue in that direction, it won't end until a complete destruction of all mankind. So we have to be the people that stop that that cycle of violence. We have to be the ones, the activists have to be the ones to reject violence as a means to the end that we want to see. If the ends that we want are peace and the ends that we want are voluntary and consensual interaction, then we have to live in those manners, and we can't have a war on the state. We have to love them. I mean, as hard as it's going to be, that's the only way that we're going to get to where I think that we want to go.
And I think it reveals one of the most saddening things about our government education, that most people, I would say nearly all people, live their lives already by an axiom that they've probably never even heard of, called the non-aggression axiom. They don't aggress against other people. They don't hurt other people, threaten other people, damage other people's stuff, steal. They don't do these things. And they also live their lives with a fair amount of compassion and empathy and thoughtfulness for their fellow man. This seems to be, while of course evil does exist and some people are, just seem to be naturally prone to evil things, it seems like a majority of people are good, are moral, decent people, and they are dragooned into this, this process for 12 years of their life where they're trained to worship an organization that basically follows the opposite code of ethics. And I think it, it explains why so many of the things that we've been talking about today happen, and also why people sit back and watch it happen, or accept the rationalizations, or accept the excuses, or welcome the promises that it will get better, or that it will change. It just matters who's in charge, or what they do, or how much money is thrown at it. All of this, to me, seems to come out of our government education.
Absolutely.
All right. Well, Ian, I thank you so much for joining me again. Ian Show, Free Talk Live. You have a brand new website, right?
Yeah, it's pretty spiffy. It lets people submit what they would like perhaps to hear on the air, and other people can vote it up or vote it down, and maybe it'll get on the air. And it's a great way for – it's actually turning into, I think, and hopefully will be a news kind of resource for liberty-minded people, kind of like a dig-like site, except just simply for liberty-oriented news stories and opinion pieces and things like that, videos and that kind of thing. So it's a real community-based site now, whereas it used to be kind of the top-down, we tell you what's important, this is our show, and that's all this is about kind of site. Now it's about our users telling us what's important to them. So it's a completely different shift, kind of the Web 2.0 perspective. And it's still free to the users. So I hope people will come over to freetalklive.com. And I hope people will also come over to freekeen.com and find out what some of the exciting activism that's happening up here in New Hampshire is. I hope that someday the other New Hampshire activists create some other blogs that have a similar intent as Free Keen does. I mean, the intention of Free Keen is to bring people to Keene, and I don't see that happening anywhere else. There are some other blogs throughout the state, but they're just more like personal blogs and not really recruiting style movement blogs. And so right now, Keene is the real kind of hot spot for a lot of liberty activism up in New Hampshire. I think Manchester's starting to compete with us at this point, and Keene and Manchester are kind of real two big destinations. And the best way to tap into what's going on, at least in Keene, is to go to freekeene.com, and there's a forum there, and there's our blog and all kinds of different resources. We just launched the families, Monadnock Families for Liberty, because we've got finally some families that are moving here now. It's been more of like single males moving, single young males moving here. So we're starting to see the demographics expand out here in Keene, and the movement is expanding, and it's just such an exciting time. And the best way for people to come and find out what's going on is to go to freekeen.com and then come on up to New Hampshire. Don't hold back. Don't wait, because there's no there's probably nothing going on where you live.
That is as somebody who grew up in New Hampshire and then lived in Vermont, New York, and Massachusetts. If the states that surround New Hampshire is any indication of what goes on beyond New Hampshire, yes, get to New Hampshire. So thanks again, Ian, and thanks for all the great work that you do. It's really appreciated, and I appreciate you coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's been a lot of fun.
Both Free Talk Live and School Sucks Podcast are helped along quite a bit by the support of Jason Osborne out in Ohio. And if you are interested in making a regular monthly contribution to the expansion of School Sucks Project, you can learn how to do that at the School Sucks page on podomatic.com. And there's also some information about options on the website right now. There will be more detailed explanation coming very soon of what we hope to do with that money. So thank you very much for listening. If you have any comments about this show, I would love to hear them. If you have any suggestions about different directions we should take this topic in the future, I would love to hear those as well. Until next time, take care. And for today, I will leave you with my favorite anti-drug ad.
I do coke so I can work longer. So I can earn more. So I can do more coke. So I can work longer. So I can earn more. So I can do more coke. So I can work longer. So I can earn more. So I can do more. So I can work longer.
Always chasing rainbows.
I do coke So I can work longer. So I can earn more. So I can do more coke.
Which leads to new problems.
So I can
which leads to new demands
longer.
For government action.
So I can earn more.
Force, which leads
so I can do more coke.
Unintended consequences.
So I can
new problems,
work longer.
The demand
so I can earn
problems,
more.
Which
so I can do more coke.
Government action,
so I can work longer.
Leads to perverse
so I can earn more.
Leads to new
so I can do more coke.
The demand for more government action, which leads to the use of force.
From the book Flames in Our Forest, Disaster or Renewal, by Stephen F. Arnaud and Stephen Allison Brunel. Page 20. Ehlers Koch was a prominent Montana-born forester who had joined Gifford Pinoch's Bureau of Forestry in 1902. In a 1934 essay, Koch poignantly lamented the effects of fire suppression in the Selway and Lacosa River wilderness of northern Idaho. As a result of his long experience, he concluded that fire suppression in this rugged, heavily forested backcountry was ill-advised and futile. In Koch's opinion, developing this wilderness country with roads, trails, fire lookouts, phone lines, and other structures to aid suppression had to a large extent destroyed the special values of a unique and distinctive wilderness area. In the Journal of Forestry, Koch's essay was accompanied by a rebuttal from the Forest Service's Washington office. The latter argued that more efficient suppression methods, not a let-burn approach, were needed and would soon be implemented. Indeed, the Forest Service was ready to raise the ante in its crusade against fire by establishing an aggressive new fire suppression policy. Beginning in 1935, manpower, equipment, and technology were marshaled in a preliminary campaign against fire under the Forest Service's 10 a.m. policy. This policy declared that every fire was to be controlled by 10 a.m. the day after it was reported. If the control objective was not achieved, then firefighting forces would be mobilized for control by 10 a.m. the following day, and so on. At this time, there was only a modest buildup of fuels in many forests because suppression had only been effective for a brief period, and in dry forests, grazing had removed much of the grass and other fine fuel. For many years, the war on fire was relatively successful. Each year, from 1946 through 1978, the total extent of wildfires in the 11 western states was kept below 1 million acres, after having reached 2 million acres several times between 1917 and 1931. The South was the most problematic region for maintaining the fire exclusion policy. Historically, longleaf pipe made up the most valuable and extensive forests in the South. Detailed research published in 1926 by H.H. Chapman, dean of the Yale School of Forestry, showed that surface burning in these forests was critically important. Frequent burning promoted longleaf pine regeneration, controlled brown spot disease in seedlings, and reduced fuels, thus preventing damage from wildfires. Other southern pines also benefited from light burning. Soon after Chapman published his conclusions, other studies revealed that surface burning in southern forests was crucial for maintaining quail habitat and populations important for the game bird hunting industry. These findings increased pressure on the Forest Service to allow controlled burning in southern forests. The Forest Service had the ability to withhold Clark McNary funding from states that engaged in fire practices, such as controlled burning, that the agency did not like. After years of resisting the scientific evidence and pleas from southern foresters and biologists to be permitted to use fire, in the 1940s, the Forest Service agreed that controlled burning in southern forests could be allowed. However, the agency made it clear that acceptance of controlled burning in the South was a special case and was not to be extended to the West, i.e. California. I'll leave you with a quick quote from Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, and have a super day.
We're going to continue to work to get a bill one way or the other, because energy is important. As you know, one reason that we have the fires burning in Southern California is global warming.